Good morning. It's good to see you. The title of my talk today is, Have You Heard the Good News About Climate Change? This is actually the fourth sermon I've given, but it's the first I've been asked to do in several years. I guess folks wanted to give you time to forget my last one. The title of that was, Does Evil Exist? I concluded that it did. Now, I'd like to share a true story with you. The night before that last service, I got a call from someone in the fellowship, someone I consider to be a friend, and she wanted to tell me she wouldn't be attending because she knew it was going to be depressing and negative, and, well, she just didn't want to face it. Apparently, I developed a bit of a reputation. When I was asked to talk about climate change, I figured I might be talking to an empty amphitheater. So when I say it's good to see you here, I really mean it. Because be honest now, when you hear the words global warming or climate change, don't they kind of land like lead? Don't they make you feel a little guilty, a little hopeless? Like maybe you want to turn away and ignore it, kick the can down the road? It seems so hopeless, so insolvable. And yet, we can't kick the can down the road. It has fallen to us, right here and right now, to meet this challenge. In this moment in history, we face epical choices, choices that will shape the future in ways more profoundly and more irrevocably than at any time in human history. For the first time in history, humans are fundamentally changing the atmosphere on a planetary scale, pumping in enough greenhouse gases to heat the planet beyond anything our species has ever seen, beyond what the ecosystems we involved in can endure. For the first time in history, humans are changing the chemistry of the oceans on a planetary scale. We risk turning the life-giving seas into sterile, acidic, and nearly lifeless crypts. I think that plane has been sent by Exxon, by the way. And these will not be temporary changes. In fact, in the case of sea level rise, we've already locked in more than 1,000 years of steadily rising seas. We are, right now, reshuffling the carefully wrought balances of nature in ways our progeny will have to live with and struggle against for eons. We all know the litany of global warming's effects: killer heat waves, encroaching diseases, mass extinctions, explosive forest fires, dying forests, famine, as many as 1 billion climate refugees, and 100 million deaths by the end of the century. What we do, or what we don't do in the next few years, will quite literally influence the kind of planet our children's children's children live on. Indeed, it will shape the world for hundreds of generations to come. These are moral issues. These are ethical issues. In fact, they are the most profound moral choices our species has ever faced. Now, as I look out there, I can see a lot of you are kind of wondering what happened to the good news. Well, I do think there's some good news embedded in this all too grim topic. Because while it is true that climate change is the greatest challenge our species has ever faced, I've come to understand that it could also be our greatest opportunity, our finest hour, our most magnificent legacy. And I've come to believe that addressing climate change will not only save lives and preserve a livable world for our children's children's children, it will salvage our souls and restore our sanity. Too often, we're told that the effects of climate change are some far-off future concern, but they're happening now. Right here in California, we're in the fourth year of the worst drought ever recorded. Our reservoirs only have 1 year of water left in them, and the Sierra snowpack, which has been nature's reservoir for as long as humans have been here, are only at 13% of normal. Happy World Water Day, folks. Right here in California, baby sea lions, starving and all but abandoned, are washing up on our shores as their mothers have been forced to swim vast distances to get food because the seas have become too warm near the rookery and their prey has migrated to the north. Right here in San Diego, less than a year ago, 9 forest fires, unprecedented in the month of May, ravaged the area, destroying homes, including that of one of our own members. Events like these are playing out across the globe, contributing not only to displaced species, but mass migrations of people, too, creating unrest and even terrorism. So climate change is here, now, and it's making us unhappy. The real cause of global warming, the real source of unsustainable behavior, is the illusion that material wealth brings us happiness. The idea that consumption brings us happiness. More stuff, ever bigger houses, jazzier cars, flashier clothes. When these are the sine qua non of our existence, the compass we use to navigate our way to a life of meaning and happiness and fulfillment, we get none of the above. The life they steer us into is neither satisfying nor sustainable. I believe this focus on consumption is at the core of much of what ails us in the 21st century. And I believe we know it. There is within each of us that still small voice that tells us we've lost our way. This isn't working. That in our quest for stuff, we haven't become happier. We should listen to that voice. There's wisdom in it. In fact, the apogee of happiness in the U.S., according to the National Opinion Research Center, which has been tracking it since World War II, was in 1957, when the average American family had one car, one TV, black and white, a house less than half as big as today's homes with one bathroom, no air conditioning, no clothes dryer, no stereo. We had less than half the stuff we have now. Since then, as psychologist David G. Myers points out, who has studied happiness, we've gotten astronomically richer, but we haven't gotten happier. At the end of the day, here's the problem with a consumer-based economy. It is amoral. Not immoral, but amoral. It operates outside of any moral framework. What gets more is good. What allows us to have bigger, better, faster, fatter, fluffier, flashier stuff is good. When consumption is our pole star, we become liquidators instead of investors. We become debtors rather than donors. We become exploiters rather than stewards. But we don't become happier. So here is the core of the good news, at last. If we are to meet this challenge, it is not simply a matter of what we do, although we will be called upon to do many things. Rather, it is a matter of who we are, who we can become, and what we value. In the next few years, we need a technological revolution that requires an effort comparable to what we did in World War II if we are to avoid catastrophic warming. But to do that, we will have to ignite a renaissance of the soul. We will have to stop trading in our children's future for the convenience of a supersized Happy Meal, a neighborhood box store, and stuff. Ever more stuff. The good news is, tackling climate change can help us lead richer, fuller lives. Lives that are grounded in community, not consumption. Lives in which we derive meaning from how we relate to each other, not how we exploit one another. Lives which are grounded with a deep reverence, respect, and gratitude for the world we've inherited. Lives in which we function as stewards, not liquidators. In the end, tackling climate change is about right relations in 4 key areas, as much as it is about cutting greenhouse gases. Let's examine each. First, it will require us to establish right relationships with all peoples. A civil society requires us to understand the deep interconnectedness of all of us. Right now, the world is defined by the exploiters and the exploited, by the rich and the poor, the true believers versus the infidels, the black versus the white, on and on it goes. The concept of we, of who constitutes us, is being splintered into ever smaller groups, like light through a prism. Fed by corporations and political parties, we are singled out and separated, classified and sorted into semi-sentient consumers. The context of us diminishes while a multitude of thems explodes. The more divided we are, the more we can be manipulated by fear, jingoism, and greed. Consumption feeds this divisiveness. It is narcissistic. It's about me, not us. If more stuff is the answer, then what is good is defined by what I get and what I take, rather than what we make and what we give. A civil society becomes secondary to the getting. Consumption makes us exploit people. If we can get folks in China or Vietnam or Mexico to do our bidding for less, then we can get more. So why not? If we can buy cheap stuff from Walmart, what does it matter if their employees need food stamps to survive? But if our goal is to preserve the magnificent legacy we have inherited, then the we must be expanded. We must care about the dispossessed, the disadvantaged, the affected, and the afflicted. We must turn that prism around so that we stop shattering ourselves into ever smaller splinter groups and move from a thousand thems to the one greater we. Martin Luther King said, "We must rapidly begin the shift from a thing-oriented society to a person-oriented society. When machines and computers, profit motives, and property rights are considered more important than people, the giant triplets of racism, materialism, and militarism are incapable of being conquered." The giant triplets of racism, materialism, and militarism. These are the consequences of an amoral economic system, a system in which more becomes an end in itself. Ask yourself, has this brought happiness? Second, tackling climate change will require right relationships with the natural world. We are born makers. For 50,000 years, Homo sapiens sapiens, man the double wise, was defined by what he or she produced. We are, in the depths of our DNA, makers, and we find joy in producing and building. But for the last 100 years, a scant blink of an eye in geologic time, we have defined ourselves as consumers, as takers, not makers. And when getting and taking replace giving and making, we lose something of the divine within us. If we have to liquidate a rainforest or destroy a climate or acidify the seas or eliminate species and ecosystems to get more for less, then we will. For the getting is what it is all about. Makers must be stewards of the raw materials they use to produce. Consumers simply want more. A true family farmer nurtured the soil. A factory farm consumes it. On average, the earth is covered with about 3 feet of topsoil. In the U.S., soil is eroding 10 times faster than it takes to build it up. We're not farming soils. We're liquidating them. Takers don't just exploit people. We exploit species and ecosystems. Giant feedlots in which cattle can't move, pigs that never see daylight, chickens with their beaks cut off, living on antibiotics, and factory-farmed frankenfood. Turkeys bred to be too fat to stand, consumed by people who almost can't. All for the getting. The cheaper the better, the more the better. Agricultural practices that are in harmony with the earth sequester carbon. They actually have the capacity to take carbon out of the atmosphere. Diets that are low on the food chain generate less carbon, and they make us healthier, Here again, doing the right thing for climate also enriches our ecosystem, improves our health, and enriches our soul. Third, responding to climate change will help restore communities. Right now, we watch box stores and malls go up, temples to the getting. But we fail to see that we're cashing in the life and vitality of our local communities for a 10% off sale on the latest gizmo made in China. We have to chase jobs to make more money so that we can afford more stuff and the family and community that defines human culture for eons is left behind. In 1950, 70% of us lived in relatively small communities, and we had connections. In 2008, for the first time, less than half of us did. And by 2050, 70% of us will live in massive urban settings that are little more than colonies of strangers. Nature, for many of us, is becoming an alien place. We know the Isles of Abercrombie better than you can than the canyons of San Diego. And you can't love what you don't know, and you won't protect what you don't love. We get the McMansions, but the rooms are empty, our neighbors are strangers, and our connection with the world that sustains us is all but severed. Finally, if we are to tackle climate change, we'll have to establish right relationships with future generations. We live in a world that is a miracle. It is the only world we have, and we hold it in trust. For eons untold, each generation has passed that magnificent legacy that is our Earth to the generations that followed. But we, for the first time, are squandering that trust and betraying the future in a tidal wave of consumption, materialism, and greed. We are, in effect, conducting an open-pit mining of our children's future, leaving behind the scarred remains of a once beautiful planet and a huge unpaid bill. Carl Sagan said, "The Earth is the only world known so far to harbor life. There is nowhere else, at least in the near future, to which our species could migrate." Visit? Yes. Settle? Not yet. Like it or not, for the moment, the Earth is where we make our stand. But because we believe having more stuff will make us happy, we act as if our world is disposable and our children don't matter. Corporations spend more than $500 billion each year telling us stuff will make us happy. They work to create new wants and then try to convert those wants into needs. Sell, consume, throw away, buy. Sell, consume, throw away, buy. An endless tautology that leads to nowhere. But what they're really doing is creating a void which can never be filled. As Eric Hoffer noted, you can never get enough of what you don't need to make you happy. Frank Lloyd Wright made the same point in another way when he said, "Many wealthy people are little more than janitors of their possessions." In our core, we know they're right. When we reestablish right relations with each other, the natural world, and the generations that follow. When we reconnect with nature, we will have simpler, more satisfying lives. Lives in which prosperity is measured by the richness of our relationships, the depth of our connections to community, the harmony of living in communion with nature. Not simply the size of our car, our house, or our portfolio. These, in the end, are the things that bring joy, the compass by which we measure true prosperity. As the country song put it so aptly, "I've never seen a hearse with a trailer hitch." Ah, but how do we get there? After all, words without deeds are mere dreams. What power do we have to make these kinds of changes? How can we, mere individuals, stand up to this tsunami of want that is, quite literally, hardwired in our DNA? Well, we have the power of choice. Each purchase we make is a vote. We can eat sustainable foods, drive efficient cars, choose clean energy, use water wisely. We can walk our talk. Here at UUFSD, we are taking this approach as we replace and repair our buildings. We will use rammed earth as a building material, use waterless toilets, construct ultra-efficient buildings, install rainwater collection and solar energy. We aspire to make our campus a living laboratory that will help show others how to become sustainable. But at the end of the day, this challenge cannot be met by individual actions. It requires a movement, and it will require a struggle. Speaking of another struggle, years ago, Frederick Douglass said, "Those who profess to favor freedom yet depreciate agitation are people who want crops without plowing the ground. They want rain without thunder and lightning. They want the ocean without the roar of its many waters." The struggle may be a moral one, or it may be a physical one, or it may be both, but it must be a struggle. Power concedes nothing without demand. It never has, and it never will. Yes, when you look at the challenge before us, it seems hopeless. But here is the good news about climate change. Sometimes David does defeat Goliath. Indeed, the collective power of millions, united by passion, animated by principle, and in pursuit of justice, is one of the strongest forces on earth. That is precisely what we hope to ignite in the Commit to Respond initiative. We hope you will join us over the next 30 days and beyond as we work to light the spark that will build the movement we need. Finally, if we were to have such a movement, it will require a passionate commitment to stand on the side of love. Love for those who will be affected in the future. Love for those who are being affected now. Love for the species we share this world with. And finally, reverence for the miracle that is our Earth. May it be so.